not a goal. Making small changes to things that already exist might lead you to a local maximum, but it won't help you find the global maximum. You could build the best version of an app that lets people order toilet paper from their iPhone. But iteration without a bold plan won't take you from zero to one. A company is the strangest place of all for an indefinite optimist. Why should you expect your own business to succeed without a plan to make it happen? Darwinism may be a fine theory in other contexts, but in startups, intelligent design works best. The return of design. What would it mean to prioritize design over chance? Today, good design is an aesthetic imperative, and everybody from slackers to yuppies carefully curates their outward appearance. It's true that every great entrepreneur is first and foremost a designer. Anyone who has held an iDevice or a smoothly machined MacBook has felt the result of Steve Jobs' obsession with visual and experiential perfection. But the most important lesson to learn from Jobs has nothing to do with aesthetics. The greatest thing Jobs designed was his business. Apple imagined and executed definite, multi-year plans to create new products and distribute them effectively. Forget minimum viable products. Ever since he started Apple in 1976, Jobs saw that you can change the world through careful planning, not by listening to focus group feedback or copying other successes. Long-term planning is often undervalued by our indefinite short-term world. When the first iPod was released in October 2001, industry analysts couldn't see much more than a nice feature for Macintosh users that doesn't make any difference to the rest of the world. Jobs planned the iPod to be the first of a new generation of portable post-PC devices. But that secret was invisible to most people. One look at the company's stock chart shows the harvest of this multi-year plan. The power of planning explains the difficulty of valuing private companies. When a big company makes an offer to acquire a successful startup, it almost always offers too much or too little. Founders only sell when they have no more concrete visions for the company, in which case the acquirer probably overpaid. Definite founders with robust plans don't sell, which means the offer wasn't high enough. When Yahoo offered to buy Facebook for $1 billion in July 2006, I thought we should at least consider it. But Mark Zuckerberg walked into the board meeting and announced, "Okay, guys, this is just a formality. It shouldn't take more than 10 minutes. We're obviously not going to sell here." Mark saw where he could take the company, and Yahoo didn't. A business with a good, definite plan will always be underrated in a world where people see the future as random. You are not a lottery ticket. We have to find our way back to a definite future, and the Western world needs nothing short of a cultural revolution to do it. Where to start? John Rawls will need to be displaced in philosophy departments. Malcolm Gladwell must be persuaded to change his theories. And pollsters have to be driven from politics. But the philosophy professors and the Gladwells of the world are set in their ways, to say nothing of our politicians. It's extremely hard to make changes in those crowded fields, even with brains and good intentions. A startup is the largest endeavor over which you can have definite mastery. You can have agency, not just over your own life, but over a small and important part of the world. It begins by rejecting the unjust tyranny of chance. You are not a lottery ticket. Chapter 7. Follow the money. Money makes money. For whoever has will be given more, and they will have an abundance. Whoever does not have, even what they have will be taken from them. That's Matthew chapter 25, verse 29. Albert Einstein made the same observation when he stated that compound interest was the eighth wonder of the world, the greatest mathematical discovery of all time, or even the most powerful force in the universe. Whichever version you prefer, you can't miss his message. Never underestimate exponential growth. Actually, There's no evidence that Einstein ever said any of those things. The quotations are all apocryphal. But this very misattribution reinforces the message. Having invested the principle of a lifetime's brilliance, Einstein continues to earn interest on it from beyond the grave by receiving credit for things he never said. Most sayings are forgotten. At the other extreme, a select few people, like Einstein and Shakespeare, are constantly quoted and ventriloquized. We shouldn't be surprised, since small minorities often achieve disproportionate results. In 1906, economist Vilfredo Pareto discovered what became known as the Pareto Principle, or the 80-20 rule, when he noticed that 20% of the people owned 80% of the land in Italy, a phenomenon that he found just as natural as the fact that 20% of the pea pods in his garden produced 80% of the peas. This extraordinarily stark pattern, in which a small few radically outstrip all rivals, surrounds us everywhere in the natural and social world. The most destructive earthquakes are many times more powerful than all smaller earthquakes combined. The biggest cities dwarf all mere towns put together. And monopoly businesses capture more value than millions of undifferentiated competitors. Whatever Einstein did or didn't say, the power law, so named because exponential equations describe severely unequal distributions, is the law of the universe. It defines our surroundings so completely that we usually don't even see it. This chapter shows how the power law becomes visible when you follow the money. In venture capital, where investors try to profit from exponential growth in early-stage companies, a few companies attain exponentially greater value than all others. Most businesses never need to deal with venture capital, but everyone needs to know exactly one thing that even venture capitalists struggle to understand. We don't live in a normal world. We live under a power law. The power law of venture capital. Venture capitalists aim to identify, fund, and profit from promising early-stage companies. They raise money from institutions and wealthy people, pool it into a fund, and invest in technology companies that they believe will become more valuable. If they turn out to be right, they take a cut of the returns, usually 20%. A venture fund makes money when the companies in its portfolio become more valuable and either go public or get bought by larger companies. Venture funds usually have a 10-year lifespan, since it takes time for successful companies to grow and exit. But most venture-backed companies don't IPO or get acquired. Most fail, usually soon after they start. Due to these early failures, a venture fund typically loses money at first. VCs hope the value of the fund will increase dramatically in a few years' time, to break even and beyond, when the successful portfolio companies hit their exponential growth spurts and start to scale. The big question is when this takeoff will happen. For most funds, the answer is never. Most startups fail, and most funds fail with them. Every VC knows that his task is to find the companies that will succeed. However, even seasoned investors understand this phenomenon only superficially. They know companies are different, but they underestimate the degree of difference. The error lies in expecting that venture returns will be normally distributed. That is, bad companies will fail, mediocre ones will stay flat, and good ones will return 2x or even 4x. Assuming this bland pattern, investors assemble a diversified portfolio and hope that the winners counterbalance losers. But this spray-and-pray approach usually produces an entire portfolio of flops, with no hits at all. This is because venture returns don't follow a normal distribution overall. Rather, they follow a power law. A small handful of companies radically outperform all others. If you focus on diversification instead of a single-minded pursuit of the very few companies that can become overwhelmingly valuable, you'll miss those rare companies in the first place. Our results at Founders Fund illustrate this skewed pattern. Facebook, the best investment in our 2005 fund, returned more than all the others combined. Palantir, the second best investment, is set to return more than the sum of every other investment aside from Facebook. This highly uneven pattern is not unusual. We see it in all our other funds as well. The biggest secret in venture capital is that the best investment in a successful fund equals or outperforms the entire rest of the fund combined. This implies two very strange rules for VCs. First, only invest in companies that have the potential to return the value of the entire fund. This is a scary rule because it eliminates the vast majority of possible investments. Even quite successful companies usually succeed on a more humble scale. This leads to rule number two. Because rule number one is so restrictive, there can't be any other rules. Consider what happens when you break the first rule. Andreessen Horowitz invested $250,000 in Instagram in 2010. When Facebook bought Instagram just 2 years later for $1 billion, Andreessen netted $78 million, a 312x return in less than 2 years. That's a phenomenal return, befitting the firm's reputation as one of the Valley's best. But in a weird way, it's not nearly enough, because Andreessen Horowitz has a $1.5 billion fund. If they only wrote $250,000 checks, they'd need to find 19 Instagrams just to break even. This is why investors typically put a lot more money into any company worth funding. And to be fair, Andreessen would have invested more in Instagram's later rounds had it not been conflicted out by a prior investment. VCs must find the handful of companies that will successfully go from zero to one, and then back them with every resource. Of course, no one can know with certainty ex ante which companies will succeed, so even the best VC firms have a portfolio. However, every single company in a good venture portfolio must have the potential to succeed at vast scale. At Founders Fund, we focus on 5 to 7 companies in a fund, each of which we think could become a multi-billion-dollar business based on its unique fundamentals. Whenever you shift from the substance of a business to the financial question of whether or not it fits into a diversified hedging strategy, venture investing starts to look a lot like buying lottery tickets. And once you think that you're playing the lottery, you've already psychologically prepared yourself to lose. Why people don't see the power law. Why would professional VCs, of all people, fail to see the power law? For one thing, it only becomes clear over time, and even technology investors too often live in the present. Imagine a firm invests in 10 companies with the potential to become monopolies, already an unusually disciplined portfolio. Those companies will look very similar in the early stages, before exponential growth. Over the next few years, some companies will fail, while others begin to succeed. Valuations will diverge, but the difference between exponential growth and linear growth will be unclear. After 10 years, however, the portfolio won't be divided between winners and losers. It will be split between one dominant investment and everything else. But no matter how unambiguous the end result of the power law, it doesn't reflect daily experience. Since investors spend most of their time making new investments and attending to companies in their early stages, most of the companies they work with are, by definition, average. Most of the differences that investors and entrepreneurs perceive every day are between relative levels of success, not between exponential dominance and failure. And since nobody wants to give up on an investment, VCs usually spend even more time on the most problematic companies than they do on the most obviously successful. If even investors specializing in exponentially growing startups miss the power law, it's not surprising that most everyone else misses it too. Power law distributions are so big that they hide in plain sight. For example, when most people outside Silicon Valley think of venture capital, they might picture a small and quirky coterie, like ABC's Shark Tank, only without commercials. After all, less than 1% of new businesses started each year in the U.S. receive venture funding, and total VC investment accounts for less than 0.2% of GDP. But the results of those investments disproportionately propel the entire economy. Venture-backed companies create 11% of all private sector jobs. They generate annual revenues equivalent to an astounding 21% of GDP. Indeed, The dozen largest tech companies were all venture-backed. Together, those 12 companies are worth more than $2 trillion, more than all other tech companies combined. What to do with the power law? The power law is not just important to investors. Rather, it's important to everybody, because everybody is an investor. An entrepreneur makes a major investment just by spending her time working on a startup. Therefore, every entrepreneur must think about whether her company is going to succeed and become valuable. Every individual is unavoidably an investor too. When you choose a career, you act on your belief that the kind of work you do will be valuable decades from now. The most common answer to the question of future value is a diversified portfolio. Don't put all your eggs in one basket, everyone has been told. As we said, even the best venture investors have a portfolio, but investors who understand the power law make as few investments as possible. The kind of portfolio thinking embraced by both folk wisdom and financial convention, by contrast, regards diversified betting as a source of strength. The more you dabble, the more you are supposed to have hedged against the uncertainty of the future. But life is not a portfolio, not for a startup founder, and not for any individual. An entrepreneur cannot diversify herself. You can't run dozens of companies at the same time and then hope that one of them works out well. Less obvious, but just as important, an individual cannot diversify his own life by keeping dozens of equally possible careers in ready reserve. Our schools teach the opposite. Institutionalized education traffics in a kind of homogenized, generic knowledge. Everybody who passes through the American school system learns not to think in power law terms. Every high school course period lasts 45 minutes, whatever the subject. Every student proceeds at a similar pace. At college, model students obsessively hedge their futures by assembling a suite of exotic and minor skills. Every university believes in excellence, and 100-page course catalogs arranged alphabetically according to arbitrary departments of knowledge seem designed to reassure you that it doesn't matter what you do, as long as you do it well. That is completely false. It does matter what you do. You should focus relentlessly on something you're good at doing, but before that, you must think hard about whether it will be valuable in the future. For the startup world, this means you should not necessarily start your own company, even if you are extraordinarily talented. If anything, too many people are starting their own companies today. People who understand the power law will hesitate more than others when it comes to founding a new venture. They know how tremendously successful they could become by joining the very best company while it's growing fast. The power law means that differences between companies will dwarf the differences in roles inside companies. You could have 100% of the equity if you fully fund your own venture, but if it fails, you'll have 100% of nothing. Owning just 0.01% of Google, by contrast, is incredibly valuable. More than $35 million as of this recording. If you do start your own company, you must remember the power law to operate it well. The most important things are singular. One market will probably be better than all others, as we discussed in Chapter 5. One distribution strategy usually dominates all others, too. For that, see Chapter 11. Time and decision-making themselves follow a power law, and some moments matter far more than others. See Chapter 9. However, you can't trust a world that denies the power law to accurately frame your decisions for you. So what's most important is rarely obvious. It might even be secret. But in a power law world, you can't afford not to think hard about where your actions will fall on the curve. Chapter 8. Secrets. Every one of today's most famous and familiar ideas was once unknown and unsuspected. The mathematical relationship between a triangle's sides, for example, was secret for millennia. Pythagoras had to think hard to discover it. If you wanted in on Pythagoras's new discovery, Joining his strange vegetarian cult was the best way to learn about it. Today, his geometry has become a convention, a simple truth we teach to grade schoolers. A conventional truth can be important. It's essential to learn elementary mathematics, for example, but it won't give you an edge. It's not a secret. Remember our contrarian question. What important truth do very few people agree with you on? If we already understand as much of the natural world as we ever will, if all of today's conventional ideas are already enlightened, and if everything has already been done, then there are no good answers. Contrarian thinking doesn't make any sense unless the world still has secrets left to give up. Of course, there are many things we don't yet understand, but some of those things may be impossible to figure out, mysteries rather than secrets. For example, string theory describes the physics of the universe in terms of vibrating, one-dimensional objects called strings. Is string theory true? You can't really design experiments to test it. Very few people, if any, could ever understand all its implications. But is that just because it's difficult? Or is it an impossible mystery? The difference matters. You can achieve difficult things, but you can't achieve the impossible. Recall the business version of our contrarian question. What valuable company is nobody building? Every correct answer is necessarily a secret. Something important and unknown, something hard to do but doable. If there are many secrets left in the world, there are probably many world-changing companies yet to be started. This chapter will help you think about secrets and how to find them. Why aren't people looking for secrets? Most people act as if there were no secrets left to find. An extreme representative of this view is Ted Kaczynski, infamously known as the Unabomber. Kaczynski was a child prodigy who enrolled at Harvard at 16. He went on to get a PhD in math and became a professor at UC Berkeley. But you've only ever heard of him because of the 17-year terror campaign he waged with pipe bombs against professors, technologists, and business people. In late 1995, the authorities didn't know who or where the Unabomber was. The biggest clue was a 35,000-word manifesto that Kaczynski had written and anonymously mailed to the press. The FBI asked some prominent newspapers to publish it, hoping for a break in the case. It worked. Kaczynski's brother recognized his writing style and turned him in. You might expect that writing style to have shown obvious signs of insanity, but the manifesto is eerily cogent. Kaczynski claimed that in order to be happy, every individual needs to have goals whose attainment requires effort and needs to succeed in attaining at least some of his goals. He divided human goals into three groups. First, goals that can be satisfied with minimal effort. Second, goals that can be satisfied with serious effort. And third, goals that cannot be satisfied, no matter how much effort one makes. This is the classic trichotomy of the easy, the hard, and the impossible. Kaczynski argued that modern people are depressed because all the world's hard problems have already been solved. What's left to do is either easy or impossible, and pursuing those tasks is deeply unsatisfying. What you can do, even a child can do. What you can't do, even Einstein couldn't have done. So Kaczynski's idea was to destroy existing institutions, get rid of all technology, and let people start over and work on hard problems anew. Kaczynski's methods were crazy, but his loss of faith in the technological frontier is all around us. Consider the trivial but revealing hallmarks of urban hipsterdom. Faux vintage photography, the handlebar mustache, and vinyl record players all hark back to an earlier time when people were still optimistic about the future. If everything worth doing has already been done, you may as well feign an allergy to achievement and become a barista. All fundamentalists think this way, not just terrorists and hipsters. Religious fundamentalism, for example, allows no middle ground for hard questions. There are easy truths that children are expected to rattle off. And then there are the mysteries of God, which can't be explained. In between, the zone of hard truths, lies heresy. In the modern religion of environmentalism, the easy truth is that we must protect the environment. Beyond that, Mother Nature knows best, and she cannot be questioned. Free marketeers worship a similar logic. The value of things is set by the market. Even a child can look up stock quotes. But whether those prices make sense is not to be second-guessed. The market knows far more than you ever could. Why has so much of our society come to believe that there are no hard secrets left? It might start with geography. There are no blank spaces left on the map anymore. If you grew up in the 18th century, there were still new places to go. After hearing tales of foreign adventure, you could become an explorer yourself. This was probably true up through the 19th and early 20th centuries. After that point, photography from National Geographic showed every Westerner what even the most exotic, underexplored places on Earth look like. Today, explorers are found mostly in history books and children's tales. Parents don't expect their kids to become explorers any more than they expect them to become pirates or sultans. Perhaps there are a few dozen uncontacted tribes somewhere deep in the Amazon. And we know there remains one last earthly frontier in the depths of the oceans. But the unknown seems less accessible than ever. Along with the natural fact that physical frontiers have receded, four social trends have conspired to root out belief in secrets. First is incrementalism. From an early age, we are taught that the right way to do things is to proceed one very small step at a time, day by day, grade by grade. If you overachieve and end up learning something that's not on the test, you won't receive credit for it. But in exchange for doing exactly what's asked of you, and for doing it just a bit better than your peers, you'll get an A. This process extends all the way up through the tenure track, which is why academics usually chase large numbers of trivial publications instead of new frontiers. Second is risk aversion. People are scared of secrets because they're scared of being wrong. By definition, a secret hasn't been vetted by the mainstream. If your goal is to never make a mistake in your life, you shouldn't look for secrets. The prospect of being lonely but right, dedicating your life to something that no one else believes in, is already hard. The prospect of being lonely and wrong can be unbearable. Third is complacency. Social elites have the most freedom and ability to explore new thinking, but they seem to believe in secrets the least. Why search for a new secret if you can comfortably collect rents on everything that has already been done? Every fall, the deans at top law schools and business schools welcome the incoming class with the same implicit message. You got into this elite institution. Your worries are over. You're set for life. But that's probably the kind of thing that's true only if you don't believe it. Fourth is flatness. As globalization advances, people perceive the world as one homogeneous, highly competitive marketplace. The world is flat. Given that assumption, anyone who might have had the ambition to look for a secret will first ask himself, if it were possible to discover something new, wouldn't someone from the faceless global talent pool of smarter and more creative people have found it already? This voice of doubt can dissuade people from even starting to look for secrets in a world that seems too big a place for any individual to contribute something unique. There's an optimistic way to describe the result of these trends. Today, you can't start a cult. 40 years ago, people were more open to the idea that not all knowledge was widely known. From the Communist Party to the Hare Krishnas, large numbers of people thought they could join some enlightened vanguard that would show them the way. Very few people take unorthodox ideas seriously today, and the mainstream sees that as a sign of progress. We can be glad that there are fewer crazy cults now, yet that gain has come at great cost. We have given up our sense of wonder at secrets left to be discovered. The world according to convention. How must you see the world if you don't believe in secrets? You'd have to believe we've already solved all great questions. If today's conventions are correct, we can afford to be smug and complacent. God's in his heaven. All's right with the world. For example, a world without secrets would enjoy a perfect understanding of justice. Every injustice necessarily involves a moral truth that very few people recognize early on. In a democratic society, a wrongful practice persists only when most people don't perceive it to be unjust. At first, only a small minority of abolitionists knew that slavery was evil. That view has rightly become conventional, but it was still a secret in the early 19th century. To say that there are no secrets left today would mean that we live in a society with no hidden injustices. In economics, disbelief in secrets leads to faith in efficient markets. But the existence of financial bubbles shows that markets can have extraordinary inefficiencies. And the more people believe in efficiency, the bigger the bubbles get. In 1999, nobody wanted to believe that the internet was irrationally overvalued. The same was true of housing in 2005. Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan had to acknowledge some signs of froth in local markets, but stated that a bubble in home prices for the nation as a whole does not appear likely. The market reflected all knowable information and couldn't be questioned. Then home prices fell across the country, and the financial crisis of 2008 wiped out trillions. The future turned out to hold many secrets that economists couldn't make vanish simply by ignoring them. What happens when a company stops believing in secrets? The sad decline of Hewlett-Packard provides a cautionary tale. In 1990, the company was worth $9 billion. Then came a decade of invention. In 1991, HP released the DeskJet 500C, the world's first affordable color printer. In 1993, it launched the Omnibook, one of the world's first super portable laptops. The next year, HP released the OfficeJet, the world's first all-in-one printer, fax, copier. This relentless product expansion paid off. By mid-2000, HP was worth $135 billion. But starting in late 1999, when HP introduced a new branding campaign around the imperative to invent, it stopped inventing things. In 2001, the company launched HP Services, a glorified consulting and support shop. In 2002, HP merged with Compaq, presumably because it didn't know what else to do. By 2005, the company's market cap had plunged to $70 billion, roughly half of what it had been just 5 years earlier. HP's board was a microcosm of the dysfunction. It split into two factions, only one of which cared about new technology. That faction was led by Tom Perkins, an engineer who first came to HP in 1963 to run the company's research division at the personal request of Bill Hewlett and Dave Packard. At 73 years old in 2005, Perkins may as well have been a time-traveling visitor from a bygone age of optimism. He thought the board should identify the most promising new technologies and then have HP build them. But Perkins' faction lost out to its rival, led by Chairwoman Patricia Dunn. A banker by trade, Dunn argued that charting a plan for future technology was beyond the board's competence. She thought the board should restrict itself to a night watchman's role. Was everything proper in the accounting department? Were people following all the rules? Amid this infighting, someone on the board started leaking information to the press. When it was exposed that Dunn arranged a series of illegal wiretaps to identify the source, the backlash was worse than the original dissension, and the board was disgraced. Having abandoned the search for technological secrets, HP obsessed over gossip. As a result, by late 2012, HP was worth just $23 billion, not much more than it was worth in 1990, adjusting for inflation. The case for secrets. You can't find secrets without looking for them. Andrew Wiles demonstrated this when he proved Fermat's last theorem after 358 years of fruitless inquiry by other mathematicians. the kind of sustained failure that might have suggested an inherently impossible task. Pierre de Fermat had conjectured in 1637 that no integers a, b, and c could satisfy the equation a to the nth power plus b to the nth power equals c to the nth power for any integer n greater than 2. He claimed to have a proof, but he died without writing it down, so his conjecture long remained a major unsolved problem in mathematics. Weyl started working on it in 1986, but he kept it a secret until 1993, when he knew he was nearing a solution. After 9 years of hard work, Wiles proved the conjecture in 1995. He needed brilliance to succeed, but he also needed a faith in secrets. If you think something hard is impossible, you'll never even start trying to achieve it. Belief in secrets is an effective truth. The actual truth is that there are many more secrets left to find, but they will yield only to relentless searchers. There is more to do in science, medicine, engineering, and in technology of all kinds. We are within reach not just of marginal goals set at the competitive edge of today's conventional disciplines, but of ambitions so great that even the boldest minds of the scientific revolution hesitated to announce them directly. We could cure cancer, dementia, and all the diseases of age and metabolic decay. We can find new ways to generate energy that free the world from conflict over fossil fuels. We can invent faster ways to travel from place to place over the surface of the planet. We can even learn how to escape it entirely and settle new frontiers. But we will never learn any of these secrets unless we demand to know them and force ourselves to look. The same is true of business. Great companies can be built on open but unsuspected secrets about how the world works. Consider the Silicon Valley startups that have harnessed the spare capacity that is all around us but often ignored. Before Airbnb, travelers had little choice but to pay high prices for a hotel room, and property owners couldn't easily and reliably rent out their unoccupied space. Airbnb saw untapped supply and unaddressed demand where others saw nothing at all. The same is true of private car services Lyft and Uber. Few people imagined that it was possible to build a billion-dollar business by simply connecting people who want to go places with people willing to drive them there. We already had state-licensed taxicabs and private limousines. Only by believing in and looking for secrets could you see beyond the convention to an opportunity hidden in plain sight. The same reason that so many internet companies, including Facebook, are often underestimated, their very simplicity, is itself an argument for secrets. If insights that look so elementary in retrospect can support important and valuable businesses, there must remain many great companies still to start. How to find secrets. There are two kinds of secrets: secrets of nature and secrets about people. Natural secrets exist all around us. To find them, one must study some undiscovered aspect of the physical world. Secrets about people are different. They are things that people don't know about themselves, or things they hide because they don't want others to know. So in thinking about what kind of company to build, there are two distinct questions to ask. First, what secrets is nature not telling you? Second, what secrets are people not telling you? It's easy to assume that natural secrets are the most important. The people who look for them can sound intimidatingly authoritative. This is why physics PhDs are notoriously difficult to work with. Because they know the most fundamental truth, they think they know all truths. But does understanding electromagnetic theory automatically make you a great marriage counselor? Does a gravity theorist know more about your business than you do? At PayPal, I once interviewed a physics PhD for an engineering job. Halfway through my first question, he shouted, "Stop! I already know what you're going to ask." But he was wrong. It was the easiest no-hire decision I ever made. Secrets about people are relatively underappreciated. Maybe that's because you don't need a dozen years of higher education to ask the questions that uncover them. What are people not allowed to talk about? what is forbidden or taboo. Sometimes looking for natural secrets and looking for human secrets lead to the same truth. Consider the monopoly secret again. Competition and capitalism are opposites. If you didn't already know it, you could discover it the natural, empirical way. Do a quantitative study of corporate profits, and you'll see that they're eliminated by competition. But you could also take the human approach and ask, what are people running companies not allowed to say? You'd notice that monopolists downplay their monopoly status to avoid scrutiny, while competitive firms strategically exaggerate their uniqueness. The differences between firms only seem small on the surface. In fact, they're enormous. The best place to look for secrets is where no one else is looking. Most people think only in terms of what they've been taught. Schooling itself aims to impart conventional wisdom. So you might ask, are there any fields that matter but haven't been standardized and institutionalized? Physics, for example, is a real major at all major universities, and it's set in its ways. The opposite of physics might be astrology, but astrology doesn't matter. What about something like nutrition? Nutrition matters for everybody, but you can't major in it at Harvard. Most top scientists go into other fields. Most of the big studies were done 30 or 40 years ago, and most are seriously flawed. The food pyramid that told us to eat low fat and enormous amounts of grains was probably more a product of lobbying by big food than real science. Its chief impact has been to aggravate our obesity epidemic. There's plenty more to learn. We know more about the physics of faraway stars than we know about human nutrition. It won't be easy, but it's not obviously impossible. Exactly the kind of field that could yield secrets. What to do with secrets? If you find a secret, you face a choice. Do you tell anyone, or do you keep it to yourself? It depends on the secret. Some are more dangerous than others. As Faust tells Wagner, the few who knew what might be learned, foolish enough to put their whole heart on show and reveal their feelings to the crowd below, mankind has always crucified and burned. Unless you have perfectly conventional beliefs, it's rarely a good idea to tell everybody everything that you know. So who do you tell? Whoever you need to, and no more. In practice, there's always a golden mean between telling nobody and telling everybody, and that's a company. The best entrepreneurs know this. Every great business is built around a secret that's hidden from the outside. A great company is a conspiracy to change the world. When you share your secret, the recipient becomes a fellow conspirator. As Tolkien wrote in The Lord of the Rings, the road goes ever on and on, down from the door where it began. Life is a long journey. The road marked out by the steps of previous travelers has no end in sight. But later on in the tale, another verse appears. Still round the corner there may wait a new road or a secret gate. And though we pass them by today, tomorrow we may come this way and take the hidden paths that run towards the moon or to the sun. The road doesn't have to be infinite after all. Take the hidden path. Chapter 9. Foundations. Every great company is unique, but there are a few things that every business must get right at the beginning. I stress this so often that friends have teasingly nicknamed it Thiel's Law. A startup messed up at its foundation cannot be fixed. Beginnings are special. They are qualitatively different from all that comes afterward. This was true 13.8 billion years ago, at the founding of our cosmos. In the earliest microseconds of its existence, the universe expanded by a factor of 10 to the 30th power, a million trillion trillion. As cosmogonic epochs came and went in those first few moments, the very laws of physics were different from those we know today. It was also true 227 years ago, at the founding of our country. Fundamental questions were open for debate by the framers during the first few months they spent together at the Constitutional Convention. How much power should the central government have? How should representation in Congress be apportioned? Whatever your views on the compromises reached that summer in Philadelphia, they've been hard to change ever since. After ratifying the Bill of Rights in 1791, we've amended the Constitution only 17 times. Today, California has the same representation in the Senate as Alaska, even though it has 50 times as many people. Maybe that's a feature, not a bug, but we're probably stuck with it as long as the United States exists. Another constitutional convention is unlikely. Today, we debate only smaller questions. Companies are like countries in this way. Bad decisions made early on, if you choose the wrong partners or hire the wrong people, for example, are very hard to correct after they are made. It may take a crisis on the order of bankruptcy before anybody will even try to correct them. As a founder, your first job is to get the first things right, because you cannot build a great company on a flawed foundation. Founding matrimony. When you start something, the first and most crucial decision you make is whom to start it with. Choosing a co-founder is like getting married, and founder conflict is just as ugly as divorce. Optimism abounds at the start of every relationship. It's unromantic to think soberly about what could go wrong, so people don't. But if the founders develop irreconcilable differences, the company becomes the victim. In 1999, Luke Nozick was one of my co-founders at PayPal, and I still work with him today at Founders Fund. But a year before PayPal, I invested in a company Luke started with someone else. It was his first startup. It was one of my first investments. Neither of us realized it then, but the venture was doomed to fail from the beginning, because Luke and his co-founder were a terrible match. Luke is a brilliant and eccentric thinker. His co-founder was an MBA type who didn't want to miss out on the 90s gold rush. They met at a networking event, talked for a while, and decided to start a company together. That's no better than marrying the first person you meet at the slot machines in Vegas. You might hit the jackpot, but it probably won't work. Their company blew up, and I lost my money. Now, when I consider investing in a startup, I study the founding teams. Technical abilities and complementary skill sets matter, but how well the founders know each other and how well they work together matter just as much. Founders should share a prehistory before they start a company together. Otherwise, they're just rolling dice. Ownership, possession, and control. It's not just founders who need to get along. Everyone in your company needs to work well together. A Silicon Valley libertarian might say you could solve this problem by restricting yourself to a sole proprietorship. Freud, Jung, and every other psychologist has a theory about how every individual mind is divided against itself. But in business, at least, working for yourself guarantees alignment. Unfortunately, it also limits what kind of company you can build. It's very hard to go from zero to one without a team. A Silicon Valley anarchist might say you could achieve perfect alignment as long as you hire just the right people, who will flourish peacefully without any guiding structure. Serendipity and even free-form chaos at the workplace are supposed to help disrupt all the old rules made and obeyed by the rest of the world. And indeed, if men were angels, no government would be necessary. But anarchic companies miss what James Madison saw. Men aren't angels. That's why executives who manage companies and directors who govern them have separate roles to play. It's also why founders and investors' claims on a company are formally defined. You need good people who get along, but you also need a structure to help keep everyone aligned for the long term. To anticipate likely sources of misalignment in any company, it's useful to distinguish between three concepts. First, ownership. Who legally owns a company's equity? Second, possession. Who actually runs the company on a day-to-day basis? Third, control. Who formally governs the company's affairs? A typical startup allocates ownership among founders, employees, and investors. The managers and employees who operate the company enjoy possession. And a board of directors, usually comprising founders and investors, exercises control. In theory, this division works smoothly. Financial upside from part ownership attracts and rewards investors and workers. Effective possession motivates and empowers founders and employees. It means they can get stuff done. Oversight from the board places managers' plans in broader perspective. In practice, distributing these functions among different people makes sense, but it also multiplies opportunities for misalignment. To see misalignment at its most extreme, just visit the DMV. Suppose you need a new driver's license. Theoretically, it should be easy to get one. The DMV is a government agency, and we live in a democratic republic. All power resides in the people, who elect representatives to serve them in government. If you're a citizen, you're a part owner of the DMV, and your representatives control it, so you should be able to walk in and get what you need. Of course, it doesn't work like that. We the people may own the DMV's resources, but that ownership is merely fictional. The clerks and petty tyrants who operate the DMV, however, enjoy very real possession of their small-time powers. Even the governor and the legislature charged with nominal control over the DMV can't change anything. The bureaucracy lurches ever sideways of its own inertia, no matter what actions elected officials take. Accountable to nobody, the DMV is misaligned with everybody. Bureaucrats can make your licensing experience pleasurable or nightmarish at their sole discretion. You can try to bring up political theory and remind them that you are their boss, but that's unlikely to get you better service. Big corporations do better than the DMV, but they're still prone to misalignment, especially between ownership and possession. The CEO of a huge company like General Motors, for example, will own some of the company's stock, but only a trivial portion of the total. Therefore, he's incentivized to reward himself through the power of possession rather than the value of ownership. Posting good quarterly results will be enough for him to keep his high salary and corporate jet. Misalignment can creep in even if he receives stock compensation in the name of shareholder value. If that stock comes as a reward for short-term performance, he will find it more lucrative and much easier to cut costs instead of investing in a plan that might create more value for all shareholders far in the future. Unlike corporate giants, early-stage startups are small enough that founders usually have both ownership and possession. Most conflicts in a startup erupt between ownership and control, that is, between founders and investors on the board. The potential for conflict increases over time as interests diverge. A board member might want to take the company public as soon as possible to score a win for his venture firm, while the founders would prefer to stay private and grow the business. In the boardroom, less is more. The smaller the board, the easier it is for the directors to communicate, to reach consensus, and to exercise effective oversight. However, that very effectiveness means that a small board can forcefully oppose management in any conflict. This is why it's crucial to choose wisely. Every single member of your board matters. Even one problem director will cause you pain and may even jeopardize your company's future. A board of three is ideal. Your board should never exceed five people unless your company is publicly held. Government regulations effectively mandate that public companies have larger boards. The average is 9 members. By far, the worst you can do is to make your board extra large. When unsavvy observers see a nonprofit organization with dozens of people on its board, they think, "Look at how many great people are committed to this organization. It must be extremely well run." Actually, a huge board will exercise no effective oversight at all. It merely provides cover for whatever micro-dictator actually runs the organization. If you want that kind of free rein from your board, blow it up to giant size. If you want an effective board, keep it small. On the bus or off the bus? As a general rule, everyone you involve with your company should be involved full-time. Sometimes you'll have to break this rule. It usually makes sense to hire outside lawyers and accountants, for example. However, anyone who doesn't own stock options or draw a regular salary from your company is fundamentally misaligned. At the margin, they'll be biased to claim value in the near term, not help you create more in the future. That's why hiring consultants doesn't work. Part-time employees don't work. Even working remotely should be avoided, because misalignment can creep in whenever colleagues aren't together full-time, in the same place, every day. If you're deciding whether to bring someone on board, the decision is binary. Ken Kesey was right. You are either on the bus or off the bus. Cash is not king. For people to be fully committed, they should be properly compensated. Whenever an entrepreneur asks me to invest in his company, I ask him how much he intends to pay himself. A company does better the less it pays the CEO. That's one of the single clearest patterns I've noticed from investing in hundreds of startups. In no case should a CEO of an early-stage, venture-backed startup receive more than $150,000 per year in salary. It doesn't matter if he got used to making much more than that at Google, or if he has a large mortgage and hefty private school tuition bills. If a CEO collects $300,000 a year, he risks becoming more like a politician than a founder. High pay incentivizes him to defend the status quo along with his salary, not to work with everyone else to surface problems and fix them aggressively. A cash-poor executive, by contrast, will focus on increasing the value of the company as a whole. Low CEO pay also sets the standard for everyone else. Aaron Levy, the CEO of Box, was always careful to pay himself less than everyone else in the company. 4 years after he started Box, he was still living two blocks away from HQ in a one-bedroom apartment with no furniture except a mattress. Every employee noticed his obvious commitment to the company's mission and emulated it. If a CEO doesn't set an example by taking the lowest salary in the company, he can do the same thing by drawing the highest salary. So long as that figure is still modest, it sets an effective ceiling on cash compensation. Cash is attractive. It offers pure optionality. Once you get your paycheck, you can do anything you want with it. However, high cash compensation teaches workers to claim value from the company as it already exists, instead of investing their time to create new value in the future. A cash bonus is slightly better than a cash salary. At least it's contingent on a job well done. But even so-called incentive pay encourages short-term thinking and value grabbing. Any kind of cash is more about the present than the future. Vested interests. Startups don't need to pay high salaries because they can offer something better: part ownership of the company itself. Equity is the one form of compensation that can effectively orient people towards creating value in the future. However, for equity to create commitment rather than conflict, you must allocate it very carefully. Giving everyone equal shares is usually a mistake. Every individual has different talents and responsibilities, as well as different opportunity costs, so equal amounts will seem arbitrary and unfair from the start. On the other hand, granting different amounts up front is just as sure to seem unfair. Resentment at this stage can kill a company, but there's no ownership formula to perfectly avoid it. This problem becomes even more acute over time as more people join the company. Early employees usually get the most equity because they take more risk, but some later employees might be even more crucial to a venture's success. A secretary who joined eBay in 1996 might have made 200 times more than her industry veteran boss who joined in 1999. The graffiti artist who painted Facebook's office walls in 2005 got stock that turned out to be worth $200 million, while a talented engineer who joined in 2010 might have made only $2 million. Since it's impossible to achieve perfect fairness when distributing ownership, Founders would do well to keep the details secret. Sending out a company-wide email that lists everyone's ownership stake would be like dropping a nuclear bomb on your office. Most people don't want